Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation. Welcome to the summer.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I'm thoroughly welcomed.
Tim and I.
Hey, hold on, listener. He just didn't say his normal thing because it's summer. It happened. Tim was like, it's the summer. I'm going to take a break from Hebrew.
So don't let Andy Never. Fool you. He's here, but he's not really here.
I'm here.
Where are you right
I'm
now?
I'm vocally here, but physically I'm on my honeymoon right now.
Yes.
And I'm having a great time, and the wedding went great. I'm sure you guys did a good job. And now I'm not thinking about the podcast at all. I'm off wherever I'm at in an undisclosed location. That's right. Gallivanting.
Yes, and so
adventuring.
To remind our listeners what a summer episode is, we're gonna have some announcements in a moment, but we do truncate the summer episodes just to make them a little bit easier, since we do these, you know, big girthy podcast episodes the rest of the year for you.
And listener, if you don't know, truncate is a fancy way of saying shorten.
And so we'll have some announcements. We will have Books in Business, where we really just have one main book, and then the other two we'll just share kind of small things. Or
also
whatever.
Truncated. Which means to shorten.
Yes.
There's no elephant trunks. There's no trunks in the car. It's just shortened.
And we're also going to shorten the rest of the podcast,
which
where we just end with the devotional.
Is also to say truncated.
Truncated. Did you know that the word spicy can mean multiple things? Yes, so let's get to announcements.
Listener, Charlie has had bubbler. We are on bubbler again. And this is when Charlie gets really, really interesting, excitable.
And Tim forgets his Hebrew. Like this, that Tim is the wayfarer on the boat of the sailor, and he shoots the albatross with his crossbow.
Dude, he's shot so many albatrosses.
And we don't even know what that means. Okay, anyway. So, we're doing, obviously, very well. And 200 for 200. We want to get to 200 reviews on Apple by our 200th episode. This will be, like, maybe 190th or so. And so, if you have not left a 5-star review in Apple with a comment, has to have a comment to count, you should go do that. We're going to have a contest. When we get to 200, we are going to draw names from that pool of 200 people, and we're going to give things away. Remember that time we gave away the janky lamp?
Oh, man. That janky lamp. I was still surprised that we gave that away, and someone really, really wanted it.
Yes. I wonder how it's surviving.
Oh, hey, if you have the janky lamp, and you know who you are, let us know.
Take a picture. Post it on our social media.
Yeah, seriously.
Tag us. Anyway, so 200 for 200, you should do that. And did you know that you could take your sibling's phone and you could log into Apple Podcasts on their phone and leave a 5-star review as if you were them?
You're so
horrendous. Then when they win a gift card or a shirt from the bookstore, you can get it.
Because they don't even know that they left the review.
They don't. Anyway, here are our sponsors for today's episode. We have... obviously, Bubbler, who we're drinking some Bubblers right now, which not a sponsor. Don't even know who makes that. And our normal sponsors, Brick House, who also was a part of your wedding.
That's right. They came into the coffee for the wedding open house style reception we had.
Yes. And Porchlight and Blue Cow, the friendlies heard around.
And this week's episode is brought to us by the letter T, or truncate.
Books and Business.
So let's have a truncated Books and Business.
I start.
Andy, why don't you go first?
Andy goes first.
No, green is first. You're the green.
Okay, so I mentioned this book, I don't know, like a month ago or something. Felicia Mazenheimer, Every Woman a Theologian. Know what you believe, live it confidently, communicate it graciously. So this book was a lot of kind of what we expected. It is very readable and kind of fun. She tells a lot of stories and then applies basically theology to real life. She kind of starts out just arguing, hey, listen, theology is not just something done by scholars. There is a scholarly component to theology, but theology is something that everybody has to live. She uses the illustration and opens with this illustration of a friend who I can't remember the terminology she was using, but basically was becoming a pluralist. And so she uses the illustration of John 14. So who is Jesus? And the person says, well, you know, Jesus is a good person. And it's like, well, what does Jesus have to say for who he is? And so she states, in John 14, he says he is the way, the truth, and the life. He even goes on to say no one can access God unless it's through him. He says a similar thing in Matthew 11. I adjusted my coffee mug. I guess what I am saying is, I like your theory, I really do, but Jesus didn't allow for it. So I respect that you admire Jesus, but if you admire him, you have to take into account everything he said about himself. He made Christianity exclusive. I've never heard it explained that way. My friend tapped her coffee mug and narrowed her eyes. I'll have to think about it. So her big point was, this is just a couple of ladies that were having coffee together. And what were they discussing? Theology. So every woman, a theologian. So she's encouraging ladies to know their theology. I have a whole pile of different footnotes and stuff in it. Deuteronomy 6:5, she has this interesting correlation between the heart and the mind, how Jesus adds the mind to it. So anyway, the book is, I thought, you know, pretty good. When it comes down to it, really controversial stuff, well, what is HarperCollins, what is Thomas Nelson going to do?
Punt,
which is what we saw. You discussed the cosmology section.
Yes.
And she went through the various views and then never took
a position.
She never took a position.
You were a prophet, man.
I was. And so there's pros and cons to that.
By Jove.
What would be one of the pros? What would be one of the advantages to not taking a position and only presenting the different views?
Well, what you can do is you can lay out the views. And you are informed, but you actually don't have to make a decision yourself on the views.
Right.
And then also, the audience who has differing opinions on which answer is correct will not have a problem with what you say.
Right, exactly.
So that's like the strategic pro.
Right. So she hasn't offended anybody because, everybody can just say, yeah, well, that was my view and that's their view and whatever. She states, after explaining the views, each of these creation theories has its weaknesses, some scientifical, some biblical.
See, and I just have a really hard time with that statement because you're saying theistic evolution has a weakness. Like the view is a weakness.
Right.
Like the entire, like that's, anyways, you keep going. Sorry.
No, I mean, that's part of the conversation. So she then stays at the end. As we consider different creation theories, this is page 52, by the way, we must remember the consistent core doctrines we see in scripture and church history. God created the world. He not only was there at the beginning, he is the beginning. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. So she's basically taken all of these creation views and said, this is what we all agree upon. What?
Just listening.
Okay. So I'm going to then scan ahead. So, I mean, she goes through the different, you know, theologies, theology proper, soteriology, Christology, pneumatology. I was interested what she would do with the whole doctrine of the Holy Spirit. What do you think she's going to do?
It's going to be the same. You're going to lay out the positions on the charismatic gifts. You're going to say, could be any of these things. You're going to move on.
And you are a prophet.
I'm just not.
Or he's not, because he doesn't have that gift.
Oh, nice. Okay, so
hey, it profits her to do her. That's like the word. Never mind.
So, she states, this is page 121, my gifts are teaching and discernment. I use these gifts to serve the church by educating people about the Bible, directing them to spiritual disciplines, and discipling them one-on-one. So this is interesting because I was wondering what she was going to say about egalitarianism, complementarianism. Okay, we'll talk about that in the ecclesiology section.
Oh,
you'll take a wild guess.
I have no idea. I'm completely verklempt. I have not a clue.
My friend Sarah has a gift of encouragement and mercy. She is full of compassion and quick to build up others with her words. My husband Josh has a gift of service or administration. He is gifted at organizing behind the scenes and executing detailed plans. The church needs all of us. The goal of Paul's list was not to systematize gifts into a neat little quiz.
Well, I actually agree with that.
I do too.
Like that. Yes. Those spiritual gift quizzes are No good. They're no almost good. As bad as personality quizzes, mm-hmm. predictive indexes.
Is there a difference? Anyway.
Corporate wants you to figure out the difference.
Okay. So, and there's, I highlight that just because there's some good things in here that I do agree about. In fact, there's a lot of good things in here. Then she does mention, your understanding of these gifts is likely connected to your church's theological stance on them. Cessationist churches believe miraculous gifts have ceased in Christian practice. Continuationist churches believe the gifts of healing, prophecy, miracles, and tongues continue today and should be practiced to advance the gospel and edify the church. Let's quickly dive into each of these stances. So then she goes through cessationist, continuationist, and then what does she say? Well, she doesn't really take a view, but the way that she doesn't take a view is presenting problems with each of the views. Okay.
Okay.
Do you understand?
Yep. So all of these have problems. You'll have to sort it out yourself.
Yes, you have to sort it out yourself. Okay. So trying to bring us together around the same common theme. So in charismatic and Pentecostal church traditions, you'll see the miraculous gifts practiced in varying degrees. Some of these churches make the mistake of seeing the Spirit as if he only operates in sensational and exciting ways, i.e. they do it incorrectly. Now, skipping to the next paragraph, however, in non-charismatic, cessationist church traditions, Christians may fail to acknowledge the sovereignty of God's Spirit. Okay, so what's then the last paragraph? Continuationist churches must remember the Spirit brings order. Cessationist churches must not let their order prevent the Spirit's work. So continuationist churches need to remember this. Cessationist churches must not let their order prevent the Spirit's work.
See, when you say it like that, you're making it sound like nobody knows the right answer and we need to like meet in the balanced middle.
Right. And so they're basically writing at a level that both groups would be able to read from the book and then be edified.
And she has set herself up as the judge over both.
Right.
Because she's not taking a position.
Right. Okay. So that's pneumatology. Ecclesiology.
You're good.
City on a hill. Okay, this, what is the purpose of the church? And then she goes through various different characteristics, the ministry of the church, teaching, fellowship, worship. Okay, what is baptism? Is a sacrament of sanctifying grace from original sin.
What?
Baptism, a sacrament of sanctifying grace from original sin.
That's her position?
No. Oh. Sorry. The Catholic and Orthodox churches observe seven sacraments with some variation in their traditions. So what does she do? Present the views. And what is the baptism? A sacrament. I'm sorry. I set you up wrong there. Okay.
Okay.
But then she does say at the bottom, the Protestant church generally observes only two sacraments, baptism and communion.
Okay. So just what's she say next?
Oh, she just kind of goes through them. Some non-Catholic churches may observe a few more, but these two are the standard. She calls them sacraments. I just read the wrong place at first.
Oh, my word.
So that one was a miss. For the most part, though, the ecclesiology section is extremely watered down. There's like nothing on it.
What? Well, I thought she was only including the Catholic view. My assumption is, she's at least a Protestant or an evangelical. So
yeah, she is.
She'll include the Catholic view to show like the extent, but she'll surely say that view is wrong, right?
Oh, well, no, I'm not sure.
The reason I'm asking that question is if she says we don't really know or something, then is she trying to be broad enough that the Catholics would want to read this book?
I'm not sure on that one. I didn't get into that much of the detail.
Okay.
I thought that she just missed with the calling it sacramental.
Yeah.
So she fails to make a distinction between the sacramentalism of the Catholic Church and the non-sacramental approach of the Protestant churches.
Is it within ecclesiology that she brings up the egalitarianism?
No, it's not brought up at all. It's completely evaded. There's no qualifications of the pastor. There's very little. There's nothing on deacons or elders. So I wanted to use this time. Well, I should say there's like two paragraphs at the very end. Pastors, elders, and bishops, oh my. All right, so then there's two paragraphs there. And then...
might we say it's
Truncated.
I knew you were going to do that. This episode has been brought to you by the letter T.
So then in the eschatology section, she actually gives summaries of premillennialism, postmillennialism, amillennialism, then dispensational premillennialism. And, you know, there's, you know, some decent stuff in here. Actually, I was impressed with the eschatology section. I expected it to be extremely watered down, but it's presenting the different views, and then people can kind of take the view that they want. What do you have?
But she didn't say the dispy view was wrong.
She didn't say that it was wrong. It's just it was here. While premillennialism may sound intimidating, this is likely the eschatology with which you are most familiar, even if you don't have words for it.
Gotcha. Okay.
The premillennial viewpoint is the one popularized by the Left Behind series. However, it's not a standalone view. It comes from dispensational theology, which is why the more accurate term for this end times perspective is dispensational premillennialism. To put it simply, dispensationalism is a framework for understanding the history of God's interaction with humanity.
That's accurate.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good description.
Right. But with dispensational, so I skipped several paragraphs, but with dispensational premillennialism, everything is a little more complicated. This is consistent with how dispensationalism views the entire biblical narrative. So that statement seemed like a slight.
Yep.
So what was missing in the eschatology section was a doctrine of hell. So there was really nothing on
in judgment.
Yeah. Like in hell and judgment. Yes.
Oh, that is not great.
So if you, this is where, you know, how do you rate a book like this where there are a lot of really good things. It's very readable. It's not going on the shock stack. I don't think I can do that. It's not that bad. There are ladies that can read this and they would really benefit from it theologically. The problem is they can't, they have to realize what's missing. In a doctrinal statement isn't about what's there. It's about what's not there. Right. So remember that when you're reading a book like this. So every woman a theologian, I don't know, I might give it like a one.
I could see that book being as useful as the mentor guiding another person through that book. So if you were mentoring a lady and you were helping her go through systematic theology, that would be a generic enough book on the topic that you could use it, but I don't think you could. You'd be really careful. And then you'd be like, now that you've done this, we can pick.
Yeah.
And you pick like some other systematic theology to go through.
Within the church too, to be able to say, okay, read this chapter. And then read our church's doctrinal statement, and what differences do you see?
Yeah,
and like to use that as a means of discipleship,
like a foil.
Yeah.
So I didn't. I only looked through the eschatology section, which is where I expected something on hell, and it wasn't there. So there might be something in the soteriology section. So I gotta be careful. Yeah, there we go.
All right, let's have a meditation on God's
word. We have many things, don't we?
I don't know.
Do you have anything for books and business?
Did I get? I'm sorry. I do. Sorry, wrong thing.
Show,
up.
My bad. There.
Quickly, because it's truncated.
Well, I know. Not really. That's like a normal B&B for Tim. here's my truncated B&B. So this summer, for my books and businesses, by and large, I'm going to go through books by C.S. Lewis, and I'm going to do it by giving you good quotes from those books. And so this week, I'm going to highlight a book by C.S. Lewis called God in the Dock, Answers to Questions on Christianity. This is a book of essays, newspaper articles, etc., that Lewis has written on various topics. And it's nice because you can read a little essay here, there, whatever. And I know I've referenced this before, but here's the quote. I love this quote. Happiness in Christianity is the topic. So he says this. Now, this is in the letter, so you want to read the whole thing, but which of the religions of the world gives to its followers the greatest happiness? While it lasts, the religions of worshiping oneself is going to be the best. As perhaps you know, I haven't always been a Christian. I didn't go to religion to make me happy. I always knew a bottle of port would do that. If you want a religion to make you feel really comfortable, I certainly don't recommend Christianity. I am certain there must be a patent American article on the market which will suit you far better, but I can't give you any advice on it. And I just like the fact that the feel-good Christianity out there that just makes you feel good and happy and assuages your guilt or whatever, he like makes a really good point that like just go get drunk. Just go drink something, take a Prozac or whatever. But Christianity's not designed that way. So that's just a taste of it.
Yeah. So just going to really quickly mention soon. So it is tonight. I'm recording the last as a guest on another podcast, the Inklings Variety Hour, and we're finishing up Para Londra tonight. Mm-hmm. I haven't been there for all of them, but I've been there for at least half of them. We've kind of broken it up into like five or six, so I think I've been there for three or four of them. And so, yeah, those should be posting somewhere in the summer here. And then, obviously, when they do, we'll probably share it on Thinklings, so you can listen to me talk about all the nonsense of Para Londra on another podcast. We do miss Tim's, like, you know, governor.
Governor?
Yeah, like, no, stop. Get over here. So, but all that to say...
Sounds like
I've been reading Para Londra, and so just between all of them, there, you know, there is a sense where I do think Lewis is very intentionally communicating ideas and a philosophy, but there's just really beautiful parts of the books, and the descriptions of at the very end of Out of the Silent Planet and in Para Londra, just in general, the very end of Para Londra, where they're up at this like ceremony of the king and the queen. Mm-hmm. Spoils, but there's just beauty, and I think so. If you haven't read, but at this point, I'm now going to refer to them not as the obviously space trilogy. You should just not call them that. That's dumb. There's a whole discussion about why space is not space in the first book, so you can't call it space. I think minimum it's got to be the Ransom trilogy. However, it's not even a trilogy because you eventually find out that some of the demons, like Screwtape, are a part of that same universe. So there's actually four books that refer to Ransom. So I think the correct way to refer to it is not a trilogy at all. I think you should call it the Ransom Cycle.
Cycle, yeah.
And so that is now what I'm going to call it. But I've been doing a lot of reading in the Ransom Cycle for that podcast and other things. So
man, that really makes me want to read Screwtape again, because I never would have picked up on that.
I'm not exactly sure on the connection, but there's a connection between like Ransom and the devils there.
Fascinating. Whoosh. All right, now for a final meditation on God's word. So today we're going to be in 2 Chronicles 33, and we want to look at King Manasseh. And part of why I thought about this is I have worked through this before, and I really, really enjoy this. But the other reason I thought about this is, hey, you might be looking for something to do this summer in your devotional time, and you might want to mix it up. And so one, I think, really great study, and especially it was very good for me personally, is to start with the Judean kings after the kingdoms breaks, and you have the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. You can read the Northern Kingdom. I'm not saying don't read it. It's just, it's all bad kings, but you can read the account of the Southern Kings in Judea or in Judah, sorry. And you see it go a little bit back and forth. There's still not as many good kings, but you can see a lot of really great lessons about idolatry, about your heart. That's the first time I really realized that the Old Testament God is as loving and merciful as the New Testament God. The people who say that God is this monster in the Old Testament just haven't read it. Like, and the people who say that God only wanted external formal worship in the Old Testament, they just haven't read it. And all through the Kings, you see this. So today, I want to do a short walk through the life of Manasseh. Manasseh was Hezekiah's son, and Hezekiah was one of the I think he was one of the good kings. I know he ended. What do you think, Tim? Would you call him a good king? Okay. I know sometimes people quibble because the way he ended was bad. And I think he's a good king who ended badly. But he was a good king. And then his son took over. And so I'm in 2 Chronicles 33. This is going to be a lot of reading. Sorry about the coughing. And so as you walk through Manasseh in this chapter, you're going to see, I think you got four sections. The first section is he's going to reject the Lord. So you got to understand that Manasseh grew up in Hezekiah's court. He would have seen a lot of the good, but then he would have seen that bad at the end, and he's going to reject. And then God is going to judge him. And so he's going to go from rejecting God to remembering God. And then after that, you're going to see him return. So like the three movements here. So he rejects, he remembers, he returns. So let's walk through the first nine verses here. Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. Now, last I remember, he is the longest reigning king in Judah. I'm pretty sure I'm getting a nod from the OT prof, so my knowledge is correct. And then verse 2 says this, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. I'm going to pause really quick and point out the irony of this. The Canaanites were wicked people, and their sin was so bad that that's why God displaced them from the land. He brought his own covenant people in. He was going to be their father. They were going to be his people. And now you have the very people who he brought into the land rejecting. And so what did he do? Well, he rebuilt high places. That's a place to worship. He erected altars to Baal. He made an Asherah. An Asherah is so inappropriate, I can't describe it on air. That's how like horribly bad it is. He built altars in the temple to these pagan gods. He built altars to the hosts of heaven, whom the Babylonians would have been worshiping. He sacrificed and burned his own sons in the Valley of Hinnom. I think probably that's worshiping Molech. He was the god who you sacrifice children to. He made a carved idol and put it in the house of God. And it says in verse 9 that Manasseh led Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem astray, to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord destroyed before the people of Israel. So Manasseh starts off very wickedly, and he leads the people. You understand, he's the leader. And he, by example, right in front of them, walks down the path of sin. And so before we go any further in this, I just want to make an application to your life. Your life is an example to everyone around you. If you walk in sin, whether you think you're doing this or not, you are being an example that has some force, influence, whatever you want to say. And part of the horror of Manasseh is that it wasn't just him rejecting God. In his rejection, he was leading an entire people that path. So that's his rejection. Now in verse 10, we see his... He's going to have to remember God. So the Lord spoke to Manasseh and to his people, but they paid no attention, it says in verse 10. Therefore, the Lord brought upon them the commander of the army of the king of Assyria, who captured Manasseh with hooks and bound him with chains of bronze and brought him to Babylon. I'm going to pause here real quick. I remember a Sunday school lesson when I was in a young married Sunday school class, probably almost 20 years ago, that Tim taught, where he walked us through Assyria and how horridly wicked they are in their practices. It's probably possible here that they put a nose ring or a ring through his chin and tied him up with it. Oh, no, I'm not quoting Tim there. I'm just saying what I read. And they drug him all the way back to Assyria. Now, he's probably kind of old at this time, okay? He's definitely an adult, and he's been practicing these pagan practices for quite a while. Here's what happens. He goes into this Assyrian prison. He's been taken out of the land, and he's essentially been living as a pagan for quite a long time now. In the prison cell, guess who he prays to? He doesn't pray to Molech. He doesn't pray to Asherah. He doesn't pray to Baal. He doesn't pray to any of these Assyrian or the star gods or whatever. He remembers the Lord of his father, Hezekiah, and he prays to him. And the cool part of the story is that it says in verse 12, when he was in distress, he entreated the favor of the Lord his God, and this is the key, he humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. He prayed to him, and God was moved by his entreaty, and he heard his plea, and he brought him again to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew the Lord was God. So what we see here is a guy who has sinned. I mean, I don't know. It seems like he sinned worse than any other king in the whole record, but maybe I'm wrong on that one. But he seems like he probably did the most damage. Are you, you're agreeing that? This is the most wicked king. And he goes, and he doesn't pray to all his idols. He knows it's the one true God that he needs to deal with. How did he know that? Well, I think it's that when he was young, he had been taught this. And when his whole life fell apart, he chose the right path, which is humbling himself. That's the key thing here in the text, is that he humbled himself. So If you have a child and your child has walked away from the Lord, don't stop praying. Because if you've taught them about the Lord and they've walked a path, it may be that one day your child's life is going to fall apart and you pray that he would humble or she would humble herself before the Lord that they heard about when they were very young even. And I think that's part of the hope of this passage is that as parents, we need to teach our children about the Lord. Even if they walk away, we have to let them know and teach them because one day perhaps they will turn back to that God. Now, the way the story ends is Manasseh remembers God and he tries to take away the high places. He rebuilds part of the wall of the city. Like a king should have been concerned about these things. He took away foreign gods and idols from the house of the Lord. He also restored the altar of God and offered right sacrifices of peace offerings and thanksgiving. Verse 17 is the sad, sad end. Nevertheless, the people still sacrificed at the high places, but only to the Lord their God. Now, the problem is that they weren't even supposed to be sacrificing there. It was supposed to be only at the temple. So I do think there's quite a bit of a returning to the Lord, but there's still some leftover work to do. And so I don't know what you rank this here. I don't know what you say is this good, is this bad. I would say as you step back from this text, the two things that I want you to walk away with is this. Number one, God will save and take care of his people in the time that he chooses. And sometimes we have a wayward child or we have a wayward friend, and it's been a long time, and we just think there's no hope. But God's timetable is not our own. And then secondly, make sure you teach your children the truth. If they don't know, then one day they can't return. I guess I'll add one more. And number three, if the thing that the text points out about Manasseh is that he humbled himself, and that's what God appreciated, that's what God wanted, then how should we reply? Or how should we respond when we realize we're in sin? We should humble ourselves. So, listener, this week, I would recommend that you get into the Kings of Judea. Find out where the kingdom splits in either 1st and 2nd Kings or 1st and 2nd Chronicles, and just start reading there. Get a notepad and start taking notes on the Kings of Judea. Write down the lessons you see, and this summer, we'll go through a couple more, and I hope it'll be a blessing to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.